that makes you whole. Now that sounds really amazing. I'm really happy to hear that. So let's go.
Good afternoon, everybody. You're listening to peoplesinternetradio.com, and this should be Sean Maguire, but he's on holiday with Creative Rebellion. But we've got an excellent host today standing in, Ole Demigard. I know many of you out there all know him. He's been about many years working in so many different areas at so many different things that I was quite shocked when I was looking hard into it last night. I'm going to read the little intro here from Ollie's website, which I posted the link to in the chat box a short while ago. Right, so here it is. I have made hundreds of international interviews, and I am totally dedicated to revealing the New World Order's agenda, including false flag operations all over the world. I am not here to spread fear. Instead, my goal is to prevent the global elite from turning this beautiful planet into a controlled, fearful place. We all deserve so much better. It's time to stop the madness and heal the world with love. In peace and joy, love and light, Ole. So, sovereign men and women, I present Ole Demigard. Hi, Ole. Welcome to People's Internet Radio.
Thank you so much, Tony. It's a real honour to be on your show, and especially in the footsteps of Sean Maguire, which I highly respect. I'm the pleasure to be invited to host the show and to take you in whatever direction I choose to. And I've just returned from a tour in Scandinavia, in Norway and Sweden, on the anniversary of this awful, awful mass shooting in Norway. I think many of you remember there was some 69 young people slaughtered on a little island called Utøya, north of Oslo. But before that, there was a big explosion outside the government building in Oslo. And I would like to take you on a trip. It's the last 7-8 days of my life. But I hope that this trip and tour that I did, me telling you about it, will show you that even though we are up against very dark forces and people that are trying to scare us into absolute obedience, absolute fear and terror, we are also somehow protected by something else. At least I will show you what has happened these last few days, that at least I can see that there's some synchronicity there that is just absolutely astounding. And that really gives me great hope, because then I don't feel so alone. I don't feel threatened in the same way I would have otherwise. Like Tony said, I've spent about 30 years trying to expose different political assassins. I'm trying to track down assassins. I'm trying to stop these terror events and false flag operations that are terrorizing us globally. But over the years, these things that I thought were totally had nothing to do with each other, the more I looked into them, the deeper I dig, the more I find that it leads me back to the small little group again and again and again. And this group is the same group as is behind the so-called New World Order. A small little group of power-hungry people and other forces. I'm not sure really what is in the absolute top of the pyramid. But using old Roman templates to try to control the masses. This has been used for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years. The same few methods. How to control a population if you have elected yourself and your pals and your friends as the elite and you want to control them. The tool they use is called problem, reaction, solution. Scare the living bejesus out of the population with an unknown outer enemy. Get the reaction from the population, with the one they want is an emotional outcry of absolute fear and terror. And then you, who they are not aware of, have created the problem to start with, will serve them the solution. This has been done for so many hundreds of years, and the only difference nowadays is that they've updated it, they've upgraded to 3.0 or whatever you want to call it, they digitalized it and so on, but the basic is the same. The same, the same, the same. And I would say after all of these years that I've put myself on the line, I've done everything to expose what is actually going on with all of these things. After looking into hundreds of mass shootings and terror acts and bomb acts and virus scares and so on, I'm not really sure if there is such a thing as a real terrorist anymore. The way they're being portrayed to us with the balaclavas, the black clothes, the Kalashnikov and the bombs, the real terrorists you see on TV more or less every day, nice suits, in powerful positions, working behind the scenes in hidden networks. So this is the scary thing, because the people you think that you can trust, the people you have elected, you think, to power positions, the police that you see as your protector, has been hijacked. They have been hijacked over the years. And nowadays it comes to a very extreme point where they're actually used against us. The police, the military, all of these people thinking that they're doing their duty are being turned against us. And we, normal people who are just searching for truth and love and compassion and getting the world back in balance, have become the new terrorists. You're listening to one that is being looked upon as a terrorist. I can only say I do not step on ants. If there is a wasp inside the house, I will get it out without hurting it. I don't kick dogs. I don't hurt anyone. My whole intention is love, compassion, forgiveness. Let's get this beautiful, beautiful universe and world back in balance. At the same time, I'm being tracked by Secret Service, intelligence agencies. I'm being threatened from different areas. I was recently, which I'm going to tell you about, told by one of the members of the Delta Force, the Norwegian Delta Force, to leave or they would escort me out of the place and so on. So it has come to a point where telling the truth, coming from a point where you're aiming towards peace, aiming towards harmony, is a threat to what is called national security. I would turn that term around and say their security. They are so shit scared for us to find out what is really going on. So all of these censorships and national security and whatever they're using at us against us is for us not to see what is going on. Okay, so what have I done the last few weeks? I felt in my heart that after doing the Open Mind Conference in Amsterdam, I was invited there together with people like Ken O'Keefe, Christopher Bolin, Ian Crane was there, Frank Rasmussen from Denmark, and so on. We went there once again to speak about the truth, speak about things behind 9/11, false flag operation, things like that. Nothing that had to do with the Holocaust or anything like that, even though some of it have done made interviews exposing what is going on behind that one, because the Holocaust and the anti-Semite thing is something that is being used when the forces behind all of this have nothing left to aim at you. Then they put up this anti-Semite thing. I mean, I don't even know a Jew as far as I know, so it's hard for me to hate them. But we came to Amsterdam, and in the media in Amsterdam, the week following or coming up to this event, there was a massive smear campaign going about calling us anti-Semites and Holocaust deniers, and this all that we were awful people and we had to stop this whole event. And it came to a point the police were there, that we had to change location and all of these things. But I think I was maybe part of making it backfire in their face in a totally non-violent way, because what I did when this smear campaign started, I just, and this was in Amsterdam, which is supposed to be the capital in the world, that is the most liberate. I mean, you can go around smoking dope, you can do whatever you want. There are prostitutes in the window for your children to see when you take a walk down this downtown on a Sunday afternoon. I mean, very laid back. So this is a place where you should be able to have different points of view. Here, instead, we were hammered with this one. And there was a female politician in the Netherlands who said, this sounds like, she said that on Facebook, that this sounds like an interesting conference. I'm going to go there. A few months before, she said openly that she thought that ISIS was a creation by the CIA, Mossad, and so on. And when she said that on Facebook, she was threatened by losing her job, and she was told she was not allowed to speak to the press for the next 2 years. This is just a woman who wants to inform herself. I mean, she could have come there. We could have welcomed her. She would have liked what we had said or disliked, agreed or disagreed. What's the danger? Anyway, she was totally gagged. But what I did was when this happened, I just went out to about 50 different international radio stations, sent out a short message. This is what's going on in Amsterdam. Please keep your eyes on this and be part of exposing these dark forces that are showing their ugly face at this point. Anyways, so we did that, I did that, and about 50 international radio stations had the focus on Amsterdam during these few days. So suddenly there was a battle for the truth. It was like the light between and the darkness starting to struggle. And in the end, even though we had to change the location for the event and so on, it turned out beautifully. Instead of 2 days, we had 1 day. So it was 12 hours. There were people of the Jewish religion. There were people from all over the place. And we even had extra publicity through this whole thing that was going in the media. So it just turned out super beautiful. The police arrived. After a few minutes, they saw that, my God, we're not dangerous. Instead, they offered to help us, you know, if we needed help with anything. So, super, super nice event. I went away flying. I thought it was beautiful because I am in love with the truth. I love the truth. It is so simple, so pure, so clean, doesn't matter who is talking about an event from different angles. They can have different details and recollections of things, but the truth is still the truth. But when you have a conspiracy, it needs to be hidden by lies, and these lies just grow and grow and grow. Fear gets added. People are getting more and more afraid of maybe the whistleblowers, or people will talk about things they're not allowed to, and so on. So there's this fear surrounding it, and that creates even more lies. And then the fear of whistleblowers make people eliminate each other, killing each other. And it just grows and grows and grows. But the truth is pure, clean, and there's always a logic behind why things are happening. So when I come to a crime scene or whatever I do, I use what I call Farmer Brown logic. 1 + 1 = 2. Follow the money. Who's got the motive? Why was it carried out? Who carried it out? And where is it leading us? So a few weeks ago, I heard that my absolute beautiful friend, Mick and Ingun Sigurdsdottir, if you want to listen to this woman, she's got the body of an angel, really. The whole appearance is angelic, but the bravery of a lion. This woman is one of the most brave people I have ever met. If you want to go to the openmindconference.com, check out 2014. We were speakers there, both of us, and listen to her speech about how she has, on her own, with her beautiful partner, given up the chains of slavery, really, given up from the state, getting out of the threatening grip of the state by giving up their passport, giving up their nationality, giving up everything they had, and transforming their house, their little plot where the house is, into an international territory called Niceland. It is a small villa with a small garden, but that was Niceland, where they, in a legal way, liberated themselves. Many people are doing the same thing nowadays in many different countries to get out of the grip of these forces, because they are really trying to get at us from all different directions. Anyway, I had no idea, I didn't think of that it was the anniversary of the July 22nd mass shooting on Utøya. But this, since I'm so interested in these false flags and so on, and terror events, this was high on my list where I would like to go if I ever came to Norway. Anyway, after this thing in Amsterdam, a beautiful man called Willem Fellenhof, who is the arranger of this Open Mind, he approached me and said, listen, we need to keep the ball rolling. What can I do? Can I help you in any way? And since I'm not very strong, I said, what you could do, get me to Norway and to Sweden, where I'm going to do guided tours around the site of the murder site of the Swedish Prime Minister, Olof Palme, to try and tell the normal people, the normal population, what actually happened there. The official story, it was the job of a lone crazy guy who just mistook him for his drug dealer and killed him. The real truth, oh my God, it is a massive, massive conspiracy operation, and carried out with military style execution, backed up with the biggest forces on earth when it comes to these type of things. And the more I looked into what happened in Norway as well, it was smelling a long way of the same type of black op operation. So this is where I wanted to go. So I said, if you can manage, I need an airplane ticket there. He said, no problem at all. I got it. I left for Norway. And in Norway, I was met up by some people that are very, very helpful. It's amazing. So they drove me down to a place called Porsgrund. It's about an hour and a half southwest, I think, of Oslo, way out near the coast there. And when I came there, Ingun and her husband, Mick, it turned out that they were going to emigrate to Brazil without passport and so on. Not easy, but this is what they're aiming at now after accomplished what they wanted to do with Niceland, where she was, by the way, arrested by 11 police officers in black uniforms and so on, dragged away to the police for threatening all of these things. But she did what was needed to be done in an absolute, beautifully stunning way. So anyway, I came down there, we came down there, And they had like a small little gathering as a more or less like a goodbye party for them. I was not aware. I didn't know any of the people there. But I noticed there was an elder gentleman there, and we said hello, and so I did not know who he was. Then in the evening, Ingun said, "Listen, I hope you don't mind. I made the bed in the guest room. It's a double bed, but would you mind sharing it with someone?" I said, "Not a problem at all." "It's a man," she said. Well, I said, "Not a problem at all. Let's have a new experience." So in the morning at dawn when I woke up, I turned around and I looked into the face of this man. He's a very gentle elder man. He's 84 as far as I know. And we had a little pillow talk. He started talking, and really interesting. I got blown away in the first four or five minutes by his knowledge and things. And it turns out that his name is Per Aslak Ertresvåg. And he, in Norway, as far as I know, is the only one who has focused on exposing the global elite, who has written books like one book is called The Power Behind the Power, exposing the Bilderberg Group, exposing the Trilateral Commission, the Commission Council on Foreign Relations, the Committee of 300, all of these groups that are part of this hidden network that I focus so much on exposing. I was invited as a speaker outside the Bilderberg meeting 2014, and so this is a major focus on for me to expose these hidden networks. And here I am having a chat in bed with the man that, had I even known that he existed, would be number one or top three on my list of what people I would like to track down and see if I could meet up with. So I thought that was absolutely amazing. Anyway, I learned a lot from him, and since I was going to do a talk in Oslo the day after, he said, "I'm going to come there," and I said, "Please, please, please, it's going to be my honor to have you there," and so on. So we parted, and then in the afternoon, I asked Ingun, please, since Iceland, this international territory, has been very, really important in my life, I thought what they did there symbolically was incredibly important. So I said, "Is there any chance of us just going there?" And she said, "Yeah, it's just down the road." So we borrowed a car, we drove down there. And like I say, it's just a beautiful villa nearby the river, nothing fancy at all, but a very symbolic, important place. So we took some photos there. And then when we were on our way back, her husband Mick said, "Well, by the way, do you know that Anders Breivik, who was the accused assassin of this mass shooting on Utøya, he is the one that is the one that has been sentenced for the crime, who is pointed out he's the only guy, he is the one who did this awful mass murder." He said, "So he's in prison just on the other side of the hill. Would you like to go there?" I said, "Yeah." I mean, what are the chances? Here I am, way out in Norway, a place I've never been before, and it turns out that Mick has his office like 300-400 meters from the prison, so he's very aware of the area, and he and Ingun takes a walk through the forest and come out right where the prison is several times a week or month or so. So I said, "Please, please, let's go there." So we go up there. And this prison, I had thought that it would be like a high security, because this is the number one top prisoner in Norway. I had expected like barbed wire, big security, everything like this. Instead, we come to a prison. It's an industrial area in the outskirts of, I think the city is Skien. I think that's the name. And we get up there. It's a very small prison. There's a high wall, but no barbed wire, no towers, no security, hardly any cameras. And I thought, okay, a little bit strange. And also around the wall, about 10 meters out, the grass was brown. And this is in the middle of summer in Norway. It's been raining a lot. The grass is green. So I mentioned it. I thought, it's a bit strange, or at least I pointed it out, or Mick pointed it out. And there was some discussion, yeah, maybe they spray the grass so that you, if you try to escape, you can't hide. But the grass was not that thick. And I mean, what's the difference between brown grass or green grass? Not if you want to hide, not a big difference in my world. Anyway, so we stopped. I got out. I asked, could you please take some photos of me? Maybe I can use this for future articles or anything else like that. So we were standing there taking some photos. And then Mick said, there's this thing I wanted to show you. Please come with me. So we went around the corner, and there was this little, very anonymous building. There's no windows on it, but there's like six or seven carports. And in front of it, there's a small little brown wooden house as an office building where there were two signs, and one of them said auto import and a phone number. When I saw that, there were some signs here that made some alarm bells call out, because I'm nowadays a friend of Chip Tate. Him. He's a whistleblower, CIA whistleblower. For 25 years, he was a deep cover agent. He was a black op assassin. He was a night stalker pilot. It's one of these black helicopters that do black op operations. He was one of the pilots in the so-called Iran-Contra scandal, flying drugs out of the U.S. No, sorry, flying weapons out from the National Guard out of the U.S., and flying massive amounts of cocaine and drugs into the States, being received by people like Bill Clinton and George Bush Sr., Bill Clinton's partner in crime, Dan Lasseter, and other people, but personally, delivered to these people personally. I think Chip has been on, I was on the Sean's show together with Chip once, so you can listen to that one. He goes into great detail. But one of the things that Chip told me, I've been talking to him quite a lot, and he said that from time to time he was part of flying prisoners or people he was not aware who they were into special prisons where they were being used in experiments, mind control experiments and so on. And Chip said he flew them into the famous doctors. I don't know the names of these famous doctors yet, but it was very clear that this was standard routine, that is where some of these awful experiments and things are being carried out, behind high walls, high security, military bases or prisons. And as far as I understood also is that it's very handy if there's an airstrip somewhere nearby so that these people can be transported in big planes and then or helicopters, and then from there transported in trucks, cars, whatever, into the prisons. So also around these in these mind control experiments around these prisons and so on, very often they're like front companies, neutral companies. These are often, as far as I've been able to find out, connected to internet security companies or telephone services or neutral ones like car import, furniture import, these types. And very often these companies are like front companies registered, but they have names that are a bit hard to track down and so on. So when I saw this sign where it said auto import, nothing like Skeens auto import or Williams auto import or Jeep auto import or US auto import, just auto import and a phone number, I thought, whoa, wait a second. So when I also saw this very anonymous building, I thought, and it's right by the wall to this prison, I thought there might be a possible connection here. So Tegan's husband said, please come with me. And we went around this building. Now we're like 30 meters from the wall and the prison wall. And there was one big container that was painted the same color as the building, so it was very obvious that it was the same owner that had done that. On the end of this container, it had a green faded color and a big logo. And then behind the building, which is where you're not supposed to see it from the road, where there's, by the way, very little traffic, if any, there was a massive big container, green, and on the side it said in massive big white letters, Evergreen. For anyone who's been looking into secret operations by the CIA, chemtrails, other major things, Evergreen is one of the companies that they have used to do that, connected to Air America and other major ones. But this is like a D1. So when I saw that Evergreen, I almost fell backwards. It was like incredible. So I said, please take some photos of me with the container. We also took photos of the serial number on it, and on the short end of it, there was a big like blue stamp where it said the U.S. shipping and with the eagle and all of this. So it was very obvious this was the American part. It was the real deal. So I thought, this is unbelievable. My God, what are the chances for me, of all people, to be shown this one? Because most everyone I know wouldn't even have reacted. And so I said, if this is what Chip... also because when we were walking around the wall in this brown grass, I started feeling really uneasy. It was like a very physically strange feeling. And I'm not sensitive to energies. When people say, can you feel the healing energies? I feel absolutely nothing. I don't know. I'm like a rock. I don't feel it. But here, I almost felt like I had to puke. You know, I sat down and just tried to breathe. And for me, it was almost like there was some kind of like energy area surrounding this prison. And that was what was killing the grass as well. It was just like if you go close to a high tension, high voltage thing, that there's something in the air that you can almost physically feel. There was some kind of that type of feeling to the whole thing. So I thought, since Anders Breivik, the man who's been charged and found guilty for this crime, behaved very, very odd. I asked, or I saw that there might be a possible connection with what Chip had told me about. So I said, by any chance, is there an airstrip in the area? It needs to be a small airport without a flight tower, discreetly located, not so far from here. And Mick said, it's right on the other side of the hill. So I thought, oh my God. Here we are, maybe, possibly right in the center of all of these things. So anyway, I thought it was amazing. I mean, just within a few hours, I'd met Ingen. I saw Art in Iceland. I woke up next to this famous Norwegian journalist and author who had written a book about the exact same forces that I've been focusing 30 years of my life exposing, then seeing the prison of Anders Breivik, and then maybe being part of seeing what could be a connection to the CIA with mind control, with the prison where Anders Breivik was. This is within a very few hours. What are the chances? Anyway, we went back home. I had to ask them to stop the car a few times because I felt physically sick from whatever it was. And the very next day, I was driven to Oslo, or I took the train, where I was supposed to give a talk. The topic of the talk was false flag operations political assassinations and false flag operations. Not a very discreet topic. But before I tell you about that, maybe we could have some music. The first song we played in this program was a song that I composed and performed together with my friend Dave Dalby for the Peace Conference 2009 in Berlin. And the one I would like to play for you now is an album I recorded. It's a solo album I recorded in 1994. But I think that the lyrics are very, very... valid to this very day. And please listen, after half the tune it starts turning around and becomes very positive. So it's called From Prison to Paradise.
is our future.
This was from my album, From Prison to Paradise. The song was called the same. If you want to, you can go to my website. It's called lightonconspiracies.com, lightonconspiracies.com. You can listen to all the songs there for free, and there's a lot of other free information and so on. If this type of information, if you believe in what people like myself are doing, there are also donation buttons. There are newsletters to sign up and so on, because I'm not... Nobody is paying me. I'm not employed by anyone. I'm just an ordinary guy trying to liberate this world. Anyway, so in Oslo, I had, with the help of some new friends in Oslo, arranged for a talk in a book shop in central Oslo. And there was about 40, 45 people, something like that, arrived. And one of them were my new friend Per Aslak Etresvåg, the author, and there was also another man in my world, a real hero, a journalist in Norway who's been trying to expose what actually happened on the 22nd of July 4 years ago when this mass shooting happened and the explosion at the government building. Because as far as I know, he is the only one criticizing it, looking at the real evidence. The whole rest of the media is just The Patsy, the official story, nothing else. Nobody is looking into any strange details and so on. He was in the audience, as well as I was later told that there was a man from the Secret Service from Norway. I welcome these people as well, because these people working for organizations like that are actually the people that needs to hear these things the most, I would say. So most welcome, and so on. Anyway, after the talk, I asked this Norwegian journalist, who's not even a paid journalist himself, but he writes on a website called nyhetsspeilet.no. So I asked him if there was any chance that he could take me for a little tour around the government building that was blown up this day, because he, if anyone, would be the one to show me what actually happened, because I'm always trying to learn more, and especially on location, because that's where you get the feeling for distances, angles, a pattern of explosives that match or don't match, or escape routes, whatever. So he said, yeah, for sure, it's just around the corner. So here again, one of these fantastic things that just 200 meters down the road, and boom, there we were. This is such an odd happening that happened this day. The official story is that Anders Breivik planned two acts of terror this day. One of them, he had made a fertilizer bomb, just like the Oklahoma City one, and that he drove it and put it right outside the entrance to the government building. Then he left that dressed in a police uniform with a helmet and things, so you couldn't see who he was. He left the area. Then the whole thing blew up, the whole area was just blown apart. And then he took his other car, drove about 35 minutes north of Oslo, where he got on a small little ferry going to this infamous island now, Utøya, where he came in a police uniform with an automatic weapon, pistol and so on, and then totally in cold blood started murdering almost 70 youngsters, most of them from 14 to 17 years old. Awful, 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 awful. Anyway, we come to the crime scene, you look at the evidence, you look at the signs, you look at all of these things. Does not match up at all. The location where the van was placed, almost always when there is some kind of explosives, you have an epicenter and everything else is blown out from that in all different directions. If you have walls nearby or roofs or ceilings, that will block that part of the explosion to some extent, but you will see it on the buildings behind and so on. Here, we're seeing a totally, totally different pattern. We're seeing there's the so-called high bit scraper. There's like a very tall building in the middle where the government was at when this is supposed to happen. And then government buildings around it that is not that high, but with helicopter pads and so on. But instead of seeing like a normal explosion where the damage is closest to where the van was located, we see that the whole facade of this very, very high building, all of the glass was blown away. The buildings even behind that was destroyed as well, but only the glass. There's no impact on the concrete, anything like that. And to start with, all the pictures that have come out, there's hardly any people at all. The building seems to have been evacuated before this happened. The street seems to have been shut off. And there was also, right the minutes, a few minutes afterwards, there were three military people with red berets and military uniforms pulling up electrical cables right in the neighborhood. These soldiers have never been identified. But the whole thing, when you look at it, when you see that there are no people taking normal photos, no mobile phones, there's very, very few people in the area. The photos that are taken from this awful experience are mostly taken by the fire brigade. The fire soldiers are from behind. You can't see their faces. they're like, there's one little fire up in an office. Instead of turning out the fire, they're, in these photos you can see that they're trying to pull a car that is not in the way, that is not doing anything. They're trying to spend a lot of time pulling it from one side of the street to the other side of the street, using a small little, like a foam machine, instead of focusing on what is actually happening. And right the minutes after this explosion, there's absolutely no people there. Then a few minutes later, suddenly you have people that have been hurt, you have blood everywhere, you have all of these things, but very few people. Very, very. And it stays like that. And when you look at so-called false flag operations nowadays, where it is a film set with background actors, so-called crisis actors, where they control the whole area, where they can control the police and fire, whoever is coming to the place, they control the key people in it. This is what you're looking at. Also, the damages where the van was supposed to stand, instead of the explosion going outwards, the ceiling above it in concrete looks like it's melted. It's hanging down like a cheese that has been in too long in the sun. It looks just like that. And then when people were starting asking questions, why is there no mark on the road or the street where the car was stood? Then suddenly, a few hours later, you have a crater exposed like 2 meters wide that was not observed there before. And also, right after this, when normal people are starting to come close to the area, there are especially one woman in a uniform with the walkie-talkie that are telling them to back off, you're not allowed to film here. This woman has never been identified. Her uniform is a mix between police and fire brigade. It does not match. And the soldiers' uniforms are not real uniforms, and so on. So we have a lot of things that are pointing to a very different direction than the official story. Then also to just walk around there now is like so eerie, because even though it's 4 years ago and these are the government's own buildings, they have not been repaired. They're standing there like a monument over death and terror. It's so odd. You walk around there, it's not a sound, no people, and this massive big, like almost like a skyscraper where the Norwegian government is supposed to have been, is still there. Instead of repairing it, they put like big plastic sheets with printed windows on it. So the whole facade of that is covered by these fake plastic things. Very, very odd, I must say. Anyway, we were walking around there taking photos. I take photos in all different directions. You know, you never know what you find or what where there can be a missing jigsaw piece to the mystery and so on. Anyway, we were walking around there, and I was very grateful to have seen it because it gave me a totally different feeling for the whole thing. So, anyway, the next day, I asked Hans Gaarder, which is his name, this journalist's name, I asked him if it would be possible if he would take me to Utøya, this island where this awful, awful, awful massacre took place, so that I could once again get a better feeling for what was going on and so on. And he said, no problem, this would be the next day, which would be the 21st of July, exactly 4 years after this hit, minus one day. So we decided to go there at the exact same time of day when this happened to get a better feeling for weather, light, temperature, all of these things. And after the next song, which is going to be Big Log with Robert Plant, a beautiful, beautiful song, I think, I'm going to tell you what happened at this island. Big Log with Robert Plant. I love his voice and the guitars and so on. Anyway, so I think by now you think you might see that there's these days were very intense and that there's an incredible synchronicity of me meeting people that I would have loved to meet if I'd known that they even existed, but here they just pop up all around me. What I'm saying is, look at your own life. When you are on track for something good, things start to appear, people start to appear, and so on. And this is also why I feel so fearless in exposing these very scary areas, because something is somehow protecting us. It's also why I'm super, super optimistic regarding the future. If you're looking for negativity or things like that, you come to the wrong place. We're going to sort this out beautifully, but we need to do it in a non-violent, very fearless, side-by-side, brothers and sisters way. Okay, back to the island. One of the sure or the easiest way to see that there is a black operation going on is not by what is happening, but what is not happening. I have this from Fletcher Prouty, which was high up in the Pentagon, one of the key people in black ops in the early 60s and so on, and who is the one that is figured by Donald Sutherland in the movie JFK. He's the one that is called Mr. X. Absolutely amazing person. Brave, honest, wonderful person. And he said several times that you need to see what is not working to see the clear print of a false flag operation or a black op. Okay, so what happened on this island on this day was that the youth party, the Social Democrat Youth Party, it was their island. It had been the Social Democrats in Norway for generations, and every summer the new generation was coming there. They had little tent things. They had concerts, they had gatherings, all of these things. It's a beautiful island, right out in the countryside, absolute stunning area. And this day, well, after Anders Breivik, the man who's accused of this, they say he went, drove north of Oslo and then came to this little ferry. It's a very small ferry. You can only like have one car on it and then passenger. That's it. It said that he went on this ferry. People helped him carry very heavy bags on board. He was dressed in a police uniform, very nice and polite. He went to the island and then with more or less no warning, started slaughtering people, walking around, chasing these poor youngsters around, teenagers, shooting them, brutally slaughtering them. Even the people that were trying to escape from the island, swimming away, he was shooting them in the water. Very cold blood, absolutely like a mechanic, killing, killing, killing. So of course, as soon as the alert or the alarm went out, the police went there and took him out within a few minutes. Wrong answer. Nothing happened. And then again, nothing happened. Everything was delayed, while this awful slaughter was going on. The distance from the mainland out to the island is about 600 meters. Not difficult to get out over there. There's plenty of small little motorboats. There's plenty of people in the neighborhood that has boats. And there's a little camping site there with boats, even for rental. Anyway, what happened was after he started shooting, these youngsters that was freaking out tried to call the police and say, my God, we're being killed here. The police or whoever was there that day answering the phone, many times the phone was not answered. And when they've answered, they say, please do not disturb us. We're focused on what's happening in Oslo. Another reply was, please call your parents and ask them to call the police because we do not believe you, and so on. So it was unreal. Also, the internet went down, so the police couldn't use that. And then loads of people, once the alarm went off, loads of police cars was heading for the island. But while this was happening, the chairman of the youth party, the Social Youth Party, his name was Eskil whatever his name, I forgot his name now, Eskil, he jumped on this ferry, this small little ferry with some other people, and just went full speed ahead, not helping anyone in the water or anywhere else, heading for the mainland, putting the ferry on ground. So he stranded the ferry by mistake, but it couldn't be used by the police when they arrived. This is a very, very small little parking where all of this happened, where the ferry arrives and so on. So the police came there, massive car, loads of cars, could not do anything. And then different SWAT teams came, so-called Delta teams. They go under different names, but the main name is Delta. Okay, they came in black armored vehicles. They came down. They passed the ferry site. They couldn't find that. Then they went to the camping, and there where there were boats, they decided, no, let's find a better place to put in our rubber boats and so we can attack the island or approach the island. But the way they did it was by driving almost 4 kilometers further north.
Every minute people are getting killed here.
Then they went to the drive 3.6 kilometers north, and then they put in the rubber boat. But there's so many by now in the rubber boat, so they had to stand up. I mean, this is like Monty Python. So they've even been filmed there. This SWAT team, black dress with weapons and everything, armor, body armor, all of this, standing up, but the boat is almost sinking. So it takes in water, and the water that comes in kills the engine. I mean, really. Anyway, so they're floating around out there, and before that, they've been aiming for the wrong island. They can hear the shooting just a few kilometers down the road. They're aiming for the wrong island. We're only talking about special ops, super trained Delta teams. Okay, so they're floating around there. The engine doesn't work. And a private person approaches them with a motorboat saying, "Can I help? Can I help?" "Yeah, of course." So they swap around. They get the owner of the boat over in the rubber boat, and then the SWAT team gets in the motorboat. And, of course, full speed ahead for the island. No. They plodder around and slowly gets towards the island. At the same time, there are two black helicopters circling the island. These are not identified, but they are on photo. And the police helicopters that is loaded with sharpshooters are told to stand down. They get the direct order, stand down. There's a police officer on mainland who's brought his rifle and sniper rifle, and he sees the gunman. He's got him in the sight, and he has an earpiece in his ear. And he gets the same order, stand down, do not fire. Where did these order come from? Who told them to stand down and so on? But what is the result of all this is this brutal, brutal massacre is going on and keeps going on. Anyway, so finally, while people on the mainland are hearing several different weapons being fired in different areas of the island, I would suggest maybe multiple shooters. Witnesses have said there were at least three, the official story, one. There are some sources that were connected to the police that are talking about five people walking around in police uniforms killing youngsters. There's a press helicopter circling the island taking photos of the man walking around shooting him. He's left-handed. The man that is now sitting in prison is right-handed. He's bald, the left hand. The man sentenced, not bald. The man in the shooting that is filmed shooting these people has a different type of police uniform on than the one that has been put forward as evidence. And when he's caught, he's in like a scuba dive outfit with the emblem of the Norwegian police. When you look at the facial structure of the man arrested and the one sentenced, I tell you, they are similar, but they do not look alike in my world. Anyway, so the Delta team, while all of this shooting is going on, the killer, Anders Breivik,
is on his mobile talking to the police commander center. I mean, who writes these scripts? And anyway, he's reporting while he's going around killing people. And then in the end, he says, Commander Breivik, ready to surrender to Delta Team. At that time, he's trying to do that, as far as I know, several times. But then in the end, finally, the Delta Team arrives. Finally. And so they get ashore and they run up. You know, it looks really dramatic. Is there a shootout? Is there like a showdown? Is he trying to defend himself? No. They call him by name, Anders Breivik. What he does is he puts the rifle down and gets arrested. Does that sound like a crazy mass killer, psychopath guy who's just shooting randomly? I would say we're seeing signs of mind control here, which is a recurring theme in some of these awful events. Anyway, the Delta Team is very crucial in all of this, because when it's black op, the attacker, the police, the SWAT teams, the investigation that follows and whatever commission follows are part of the crime. They are part of the crime. Key people, key positions in Freemasonry networks, as well as including like Bilderberg groups, the Trilateral, these type of hidden pieces of the world government. And at this time, Norway, as part of NATO, was trying to pull out of the unjust bombings of Afghanistan and Libya. Had they pulled out, Denmark would have followed. That is what I've been informed, because this was so unjust and it was just too much for Scandinavian countries. After this happened, they got back in line, and nothing else was mentioned. I think they were talking, I'm not sure if they had already done it, but they had accepted or were thinking about accepting Palestine as a nation on its own. This I need to look into more deeply, but as far as I know at this point. So if this is a black op, if this is not the work of a lone crazy guy, by the way, they always want them alone and crazy, alone, because then by law, there's no conspiracy. You can deal with it in a totally different way. You don't need to look at any planning or anything like that. You can just, especially if the guy gets killed, which you will see on a regular basis, is killed, lone, crazy, case closed. Thank you, folks, and goodbye. Do not even come and look at this again. And the reason they want him crazy is because then there's no motive. He was just crazy. He did it for no apparent reason. Case closed. Thank you and goodbye. Exit to the left. So, we came to this island, beautiful island. I mean, the area is just stunning. The sun was there. It was going down a little bit. The temperature, everything was exactly like 4 years earlier, even though there was a little bit of rain before earlier in the day. And for me, I mean, I'm not a religious person, but my God, when you feel the pain, all of these victims, I could almost hear the shooting and the screaming in my ears, you know, inner ears, and all of this sadness and tragedies that has come from this area by people. Innocent pieces in this chess play of international politics that is just carried out with no regards whatsoever for an ordinary people. They're just collateral damage needed to add to the emotional effect. The more dead, the better effect you have. So anyway, we came to this little camping site, and there was this Norwegian journalist waiting. Excellent guy. So cool, so laid back. Hadn't really shaved, with a cap on, glasses. And he hadn't had lunch, so he had brought this bowl of pasta with the plastic still on it. So he was sitting there scooping away with the pasta when we arrived. So we said hello and so on. Then we went into the camping. There's a little office there. And the idea was that we would find out if the ferry was going to go there. If not, that we could rent maybe a motorboat or a canoe or something like that to get over to the island. That was the whole idea.
to see it for ourselves and out of respect for the dead, get the emotional connection so that we can do whatever it takes to sort these awful atrocities out. Anyway, we went in, and there was this young girl in her 20s meeting us in the reception. And we said, so could you tell us when the ferry leaves today? And she said, she acted a bit strange, I thought, because she's apparently, according to her, the ferry was not in use that day. Okay. So we said, I see you have a motorboat for rent for rental. Could we rent that one? And she said her eyes was a bit avoiding us. She said, I'm sorry, but the guy with a license is not here. Not that I understand what a person with a license has to do about renting a boat that they have there. So we said, so can we rent two canoes? Because we were four. It was me, the journalist, and a friend of mine who had helped with a talk in Oslo, and his girlfriend. So we were four in total. Two canoes. So she said, yes. She said, when? I said, today, now. And she said, okay, now? Yeah. I said, yeah, that would be great. So she gave me this paper to fill out, and I filled in my name and things. But while I was doing that, my friend went to use the bathroom. And when he came back, he started talking to a girl that was working inside the cafeteria on the other side. And she was very open, you know, totally different to the first one, saying, yeah, of course, no, the ferry is leaving. As far as I know, it's going on a regular basis. Just go there and it will take you over, no problem. And we asked her a little bit about this, what was going on the anniversary on the following day and so on. She told us about the I don't know what to call it, the art piece that they had put there that was going to be revealed and so on for the families and so the next day. So I went back to the first girl and said, listen, it seems like the ferry might be leaving, so we're going. So if please keep the paper, I'll go there. If we can use the ferry, great. If not, we'll come back and we'll rent the canoes. Fine. So we went out in the car, I took the bowl with pasta, we went over to the ferry place, which is about 500-600 meters south of that, and we went down there. It's a tiny little parking, maybe there can be in total 30, 40, 50 cars, nothing more, maximum. And there was this ferry, this small little ferry that was very central in this whole drama, because that blocked the whole possibility for normal police to approach the island, for the SWAT team to approach and so on. So that is very central in the whole thing. His name is, by the way, Eskil Petersen, the guy who took it. And so we stopped and we went out. And I when I looked at the vehicles that were there, because there was absolutely no people, I reacted because there was one Red Cross car, two from Norwegian Folkehelse, which is a health organization, that was also on the island the day it happened. There was one police car and there was one ambulance. So I thought out of these eight or nine cars, quite a lot of official vehicles. So I discreetly photoed the cars just in case. You never know in the future what might pop up and so on. And then I asked my friends to please take a photo of me in front of the ferry that can maybe be useful for a future article or something like that. And then next to the ferry was a brown, like wooden boat, one of these that you see in like Amsterdam or Copenhagen, taking tourists around with a guide and a microphone. Beautiful little boat, wide. And this seemed to be like one of them going up the fjords in Norway around there. But that was there, and there was people in that one. And then I saw to the right of us, there was like a small little party tent, and underneath it there were two people from the Red Cross sitting there. Not, you know, like normally you see in a marketplace where they have these tables and they give out brochures and so on, that type of thing. But here they were just sitting there on chairs. So we went over there and asked, excuse me, but do you know when the next boat goes to the island? And they said, they were very nice, but they said, the last one will leave the island at 6:15.
So I went back to them and said, but I'm not really interested in when I will leave the island. I'm interested in how we can get over there. And then she said, well, it comes and goes all the time. And I went back and I thought, the ferries here, what boat are they talking about? Because we're only talking about a distance of like 600 meters. You can see very clearly the island. You can see everything on the island there. And it's a very small island. Anyway, what I noticed was that there was a similar tent on the other side by the bridge there. So we decided, okay, let's just wait and see whenever the boat comes. We were four people that were in total. Then after maybe 10, 15 minutes, something like that, suddenly we saw there were like three or four people in like wetsuits with headsets that came running out of this brown wooden boat, this tourist type of thing, jumped into like a rubber boat with, I think, two engines behind, a very fast one. One of these, you know, with a small little tower so you stand up and drive it, and took off towards the island. I mean, full speed ahead. And we thought there's some kind of emergency, maybe an appendix, bursting appendix, maybe a heart attack on the island, something like that. We didn't understand. But they were full speed ahead up, which was perfect for me because I started filming them just to get the timing, you know, how long would it take for an emergency boat to come to the island compared to that it took more than an hour while the slaughter was going on. It took more or less exactly 1 minute from the mainland to the island. That is how fast they could have gone there. So we see the boat arrive, and then it's there for maybe half a minute or something, and then it comes back full speed, full throttle ahead, you know, coming towards us. And while it comes towards us, there are other people coming out from this brown boat. There are two people in Navy uniforms. I'm not saying that they were Navy military people, but they were in the same blue uniforms with the golden things on their shoulders. Two white-haired gentlemen. They came out of the boat. There were two or three Red Cross people, and then the three that jumped in the rubber boat, and so on. So these people were in the area, and then I think they got back in the boat. I don't know what happened with them. But anyway, this rubber boat came full throttle ahead towards us, and I turned towards my friends, and we were just saying, not understanding what was going on. So when the boat arrives, two police officers jumps out. One of them, one male, one female. The male officer, very fit, in his early 30s, blue-green eyes or yellow-green eyes, quite tall. And they come up and approaches us right away. Before they came, I said to the other ones, we're getting a visit. They thought that these people were just running towards the vehicle and taking off because something had happened. But they came and approached us right away. And so they said, hello, hello, very polite, but very strict at the same time. So they said, could we please see some ID? And in the way I've studied history, a sure sign of dictatorship, one of the first signs is that the normal person needs to carry ID and can be approached at all times by the authorities, having to identify him, having to explain, and being also suddenly in a situation where they can be taken away or whatever. So I'm totally against things like that, because that is the sign of a dictatorship. Anyway, we were four there. There were two that had nothing to do with this, and then me and my friend, my new friend, the journalist with the pasta bowl, who was still eating away. These two police officers, armed, stood in front of us, and he said, please identify yourself. So my friend Hans Gorder, the journalist, he said, but listen, why do we have to show ID? We're standing here. It's an a public space. You know, we're just waiting for the ferry. Why? And he said, I'm not interested in any games or discussions. Show us your ID. And he just carried on totally fearless. I was applauding him in the background, still eating from the pasta bowl. And he said, but why? You know, please explain yourself. Are we suspected of any kind of anything, you know, like terrorist activities? Or what? So the guy, the police said, listen, you come with me. And he just pulled him aside about 5-10 meters to the side. And he told his partner, you check out these other three. So she turned to us and said, please show your ID. I didn't show anything, but the two other ones picked up their ID. I had my passport in my pocket, but I felt I'm not giving them that. At the same time, you have to choose your so-called wars. You know, is it worth it to stand up in this situation? Can it mess it up for the other people? What good will it do if I'm getting pulled away in this situation? And so on. So what I said was, I've got this Spanish insurance card. You can have that because I live in Spain. Because two of my friends was murdered after many years of investigating the assassination of the Swedish Prime Minister. I had a visit at home, scared me shitless, and we left Sweden. Been living in Spain since then. So it was a Spanish insurance card. Anyway, she wrote it down, and the other officers came down, came back, and then he went away with his walkie-talkie, starting to communicate with someone. I don't know who. Took a few minutes, and then the police officer came and stood right in front of me, broad bent, his legs apart, and just said, Ole Damegård, I have to tell you, Swedish and Norwegian police, you have a clean slate with them. There's nothing they can tie you in with, but I have to inform you, you are not welcome here at this time, at this place. You will be welcome maybe on a later date. But today and tomorrow, you are not welcome here. You are. You can choose to leave on your own, or we will help you, assist you to do that. I was looking totally calm into his eyes because, I don't know, sometimes I get afraid and shaky, but this time I did not. And I was watching his eyes, you know, and they were a bit shifty. But here, once again, a man who was protecting something he was not aware of, at least not the dark, the top agenda, I would say. So my friend, the Norwegian journalist, he said, but maybe we can have your name, you know. And the guy just said, shook his head, said, absolutely not. Still eating the pasta, he said, but maybe how about a photo together? And he was sort of approaching him, trying to put his hand on his shoulder to take a photo, and the police just said, stop it, stop. And then the police said, but you can have my employment number, the serial number as a police officer. And the number he gave us was Delta 031. Delta 031. So here we were suddenly looking into the eyes of someone from the Delta forces that were maybe part of the operation carried out 4 years earlier and now part of protecting the whole thing. I'm not talking about this as a tiny little operation. I'm talking what seems to be, the more you dig into it, an operation including the CIA, the Mossad, parts of the Norwegian police justice department and government building and so on and so on. Big, 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 big thing. Anyway, we decided to leave. We said bye-bye, and we drove back to the camping. So we were there for an hour or two, and I was just sitting by the water and feeling the pain for these awful, awful things and family tragedies and all these things. It was an awful event. But anyway, since I was not welcome there anymore, I decided to leave. And now I would like to play some more music for you. Beautiful guitar solo. I think the best guitar solo ever, almost. It's David Gilmour and Pink Floyd, and We Don't Need No Education. Because when you start looking into these things, you will find that the power behind the scenes are also controlling the education. What our children and we are being fed to keep us in control. So here goes.
Need no education.
We don't need no education with Pink Floyd. I would say we need a lot of education, but real education, not the thing that we've been pumped with for such a long time, controlled by the elite few just trying to use it to control us. So I'm totally for education, but real thing. And this is also what I'm trying to spread, is the real information, the real truth. Up to you to decide if this is believable or not. That's up to you. I can only be responsible for what I say. You are responsible for what you understand and what you spread. Anyway, so this police officer, the way he was speaking to me, he was mentioning my talk in Oslo, that he was aware of that. And he said that we know that you looked into different assassinations and so on, and that you're connecting it. And that type of information is not welcome here at this point. If he was doing the real thing, I would totally respect him, because I can understand if there's a memorial ceremony for the families and friends of the victims. If this is going on and they fear that someone like me would come there and start with a bullhorn talking about conspiracies and so on, I can totally understand if they did not want me there. Here I was in a different role, though. And we were talking about what actually happened there. I believe that what happened was that I gave my name to the girl in the reception, and that while we were standing waiting there, she called and just said, listen, we've had some people here wanting to rent canoes going out to the island, so you asked me to be in touch with you, and here I am. So she contacted them. They went over to the island, recognized my name, and because of my talk and other things I've done, and just said full throttle ahead, came over and got rid of me. I think that is what happened. At least that makes sense to me. But surrounding many of these awful atrocities are very often key people, and these key people are on a regular basis member of the so-called Bilderberg group. So when I look at these things, I also look, is there anyone there connected or part of these hidden networks that are playing central roles in this scenario? And in this scenario, we have the former Prime Minister Gro Harlem Brundtland. She was a Bilderberger, very high up in the elite, very nice looking woman. She's very pleasant, funny, and so on. So you would never think anything sinister about her, but when you look at her actions, it's just like horrendous. She is one of the writers, authors, and architects behind what is called the Agenda 21. Agenda 21. Anyone who's looking into these things, please look into that, because that is the template of what they're trying to transform the world into. An incredibly scary book to read. But this is, it's not a book, actually, it's a plan, and it's been approved by many, many countries already. Together with Moira Strong, another member of the elite, she has wrote this Agenda 21. Anyway, the morning of this massacre, she came to the island to talk to these youngsters, and she was there more or less the whole day, and then left about an hour and a half or 2 hours before the shooting started, with this tiny little ferry going to this tiny little island and so on. And when you look at some of these mass murders, there's sometimes a ritualistic, satanic undertone, almost like a sacrifice of lives. I'm just pointing these things out. I'm not saying for sure that they are this like this. The Prime Minister of Norway at this time was Jens Stoltenberg, who was a Bilderberger, just as his father, Thorvald Stoltenberg. And the young man who was the head of the youth party at this time, who was the guy who escaped and who has changed his story about what happened several times, very hard to know what actually happened around this guy, Eskil Pedersen. He was the guy who jumped on the ferry, put it on ground so that it couldn't be used, and after, even though it was a very cowardly way of dealing with the situation, has risen in the ranks of politics. He, according to inside sources, is said to be the illegitimate son of Jens Stoltenberg. He speaks, when you listen to them, they're very similar in the way of speaking, the tone of voice, and so on. So here we have three people very tightly connected, possibly. And Jens Stoltenberg was afterwards the man who stood up as a prime minister, spoke to the people, was together with the victims, doing all of these speeches that they always do after these massacres, is that this tragedy will unite the nation, that we will stand up against terrorism, they will not bend us, and all of these. He is now a NATO, the general, the key power person in NATO, which is a Bilderberg appointment. So, you look at these people surrounding this horrific thing, and you look at Jens Stoltenberg, his behavior this day. Because he was officially in Oslo. I mean, there was nothing, nobody knew about that anything would happen at Utøya before the shooting started. Officially, he was in Oslo when this bomb exploded outside the government building. And national TV, Norwegian TV, called him up asking him to give a comment about the whole thing, and I've got it on video. It's like they say, so what's going on? What's happened? And he said, we're not sure if it's a terror attack yet, but we're there for the families of the victims, and all of, we're still trying to understand what is going on and how we should act and so on. While this is happening, you look up in the left corner of this TV broadcast, live broadcast, and it says live Utøya. He was officially in Oslo in his the house for the prime minister, but here it says live from Utøya. These are like a few hours before the shooting starts. I work with TV4 in Sweden. I did some music for them, and I have a friend who worked for the graphic department for a long time, and when I was there many times, I saw that something happens. The reporter, who does not know the whole thing at all, he's just doing his job, contacts the government saying, we need to get a comment from the prime minister. Okay, he will then be directed from whoever answers the phone saying, okay, here's where the prime minister is, and they open a phone line. He has been informed that Jens Stoltenberg was on Utøya, then contacted the graphic department, which is standard procedure, saying, please have a photo of the prime minister. We'll have the moving graphics in the background from the place where the bomb has exploded, and then he's on Utøya. So the graphic department has just done their job. They found the photo of the prime minister, they had the filmed event in the background, and then of course since he's on Utøya, they just like live from Utøya. That is, in my world, a massive smoking gun saying he was not there. He was on the island where all of this was being prepared, with the black ops, with black helicopters, with Gro Harlem Brundtland, with the whole thing set up for an absolute slaughter. I would very much say to Mr. Dear NATO General Jens Stoltenberg, what were you doing there? It's time to speak openly about these things. Anyway, we were talking about synchronicity and these things that are just showing us the way in some miraculous way. I do not know what's going on, but it really feels like something is guiding us, supporting us, through this so-called battle, how to transcend this very dark and sinister agenda. And when we went back to Oslo, I was supposed to go to Stockholm because I was going to do 5 guided tours around the site where Olof Palme was murdered, which is a totally incredible conspiracy, that one as well. And since I didn't have funds and so on, and I did not know how I was going to come from Oslo to Stockholm, but I was totally open and prepared that some beautiful way will open up getting me there. So out of the blue, a friend of Ingun had a friend that was this very day driving a friend from Oslo to Stockholm. Absolutely amazing. I was just so happy, so blessed, so this whole thing. Anyway, so I never met the guy. He came and picked me up. He picked me up just a few hundred meters from where Anders Breivik is said to have parked the car before the shooting. Once again, I was right there on site, having no idea that I was actually so close once again to this whole thing. Anyway, before we drove off, he said, I'm just going to pick up some friends. We're going to the beach. I'm going to have a swim, and then we can take off because it's a 5-6 hour drive. So I said, fine, I'll be happy to join you. Come with you. So we went down there, beautiful beach and so on. And while they were jumping in and out from the cliffs, he sat down, the guy that was going to drive me, and said, do you know this area is owned by the Norwegian royal family? And they often came here and so on. And by the way, do you know that right over there is the house of Gro Harlem Brundtland? I almost fell off the cliff. And he saw my expression, so he said, do you want to go there? I said, yeah, please take me there. So when they were ready, we drove around. I mean, it's like a 2-minute drive, 3-minute drive maximum. And when you see the power structure around these conspiracies on a global scale and over the time in history, some of these people are connected in ways that we do not see, and some of the things that keeps repeating are members of this global elite, also different things that are connected to the Holocaust, and also things that are connected to Freemasonry. I'm only saying this is what I've seen again and again and again and again. So when these things keeps repeating, I start seeing or talking about that there might just be a possible connection. So he takes me, he drives me into this villa area and stops. There's this white house, discreet among the other ones. That is where Gro Harlem Brundtland is apparently living. So I said, please, can you take a photo of me in front of this house? He said, yeah, of course. He takes a photo, and then we drive away. On the way, when we drive away there, it says the Freemasonry or something like the home for Freemasons, for elderly Freemasons. It's just like 100 meters. So I'm like, whoa, hang on 2 seconds. What is this? They said, no, I'll take you there. So we drive in there. We take some photos there. It's a very beautiful, quiet area. There's some old guys with wheelchairs rolling around and so on. So I just thought, that's, once again, you know, she lives there, Freemasonry here. I've seen it before. So we drive around the corner, and it's like another 100 meters, just like 150, 200 meters from a house, and there's the entrance for the Holocaust Museum. So I'm saying, this is unreal. So we drive in there, and it turns out that the Holocaust Museum is the property formerly owned by a man, the leader of Norway during the Second World War, whose name was Quisling, who's now seen as a total traitor to the Norwegian people. So his name, Quisling, is now synonymous with traitor. You use that as the word of traitor. So I was just blown away. And so we took photos there. We turned around, took photos down towards Gro Harlem Brundtland's house and so on. And then we took off. And I'm just telling you these things. It kept on like this for the next few days as well. How incredible synchronicity I was taking into places that with high security clearance that I didn't even know they existed. But by people who said, well, by the way, would you like to see this? Yeah, and pulling these jigsaw puzzles together for future jigsaws to be helping to put this thing together. Once again, together is the word. And this is why I feel fearless, because there's something bigger than us that are in the background as, cheering us on, helping us when we feel absolutely burnt out and sad and desperate and frustrated. It's there. It's right there in front of you. And I was being driven around by another beautiful guy in Sweden who offered to be my driver in Sweden. I mean, my God, I've done 30 years absolutely alone, and suddenly people are like saying, please, can I buy you dinner? Can I drive you here? Can I drive you there? Just because they're fans of truth. They love the truth. And here is something that is showing the way, I would say, without polishing my halo. Anyway, so he was driving me around, and I lost the thread now. But one of the things was that I had to get him to stop the car at one point, because all of these emotions coming, you know, from being at this island where all of these beautiful youngsters had been slaughtered in cold blood, having been to the Freemasonry, the Holocaust, it was just too much, and also this prison what I believe is a totally innocent man is sitting in there being blamed for these awful horrocities, killings, and things, being absolutely innocent and built in this energy secured weapon. I don't know what they had around that building. It became too much for me. So I just asked my friend here, please just pull over and stop here. I just need some fresh air. And while we were standing there, because I felt tears in my eyes, I just felt it is a bit much for me to carry around here. So somebody called me out, and on the other side of the road, there was this, I don't know where he came from, he was in black, he looked like a Romanian guy pulling a bicycle, and he just smiled at me, did not say a word, smiled at me with this beautiful, beautiful smile, and then he started blowing kisses to me, like big, big kisses like this. Maybe in other people's worlds, he was just a poor Romanian dropout looking for bottles to sell to get some income. In my world, he came from somewhere else just showing me, don't worry, sweet brother. We're in this together. You're doing it for the beauty and love of all. Don't worry, you will be fine. They will try to kick your butt. They will try to mess you up. Don't worry, everything will be fine. Just do not give up. You still need some strength, so here's a beautiful smile and some blowing kisses that will get you right back up in the saddle, which is exactly what it did. And after that, I felt empowered once again. When I looked back on the other side of the street, he was not there anymore. Different ways of looking for it. This is my naive way of seeing it. This is the way that keeps me going. And I would very much like to play you Still Got the Blues with Gary Moore, another amazing guitarist that died just a few kilometers from where I live here outside Estepona in Spain. So, Still Got the Blues with Gary Moore.
Just a game, playing to win, but you lose just the same.
Still Got the Blues with Gary Moore. I think that we all have these things happening around us, but it's like the way to, you need to observe that they're being around us, and you need to be grateful for everything you receive. That way these type of things will happen more and more. At least that's my experience in my life. The more grateful I am, the more I express and feel gratitude inside, it's like the magnet pulling these incredible things of synchronicity into your life, in whatever direction you aim your focus. I would like to finish with a story around Gary Moore, which I think was one of the absolute top guitarists of all times. This was a man that was not handed a very nice personality. He was not, as far as I know, he was not so good with people or saying things and things like that. He was not a pretty boy either. God didn't give him a face that was so nice to watch. But my God, when he was playing, whoa. And me as a guitarist, I always felt so inspired by listening to him. And I had this wish, desire that one day that I would meet him and just express how grateful I was to him. Then one day I was driving down the road here in Estepona in southern Spain, and I hear that Gary Moore has died in a hotel just outside Estepona. It was just like down the road, 2 kilometers from me. For one thing, I was totally shocked because he was only like 58. And at the same time, I felt, oh my God, I need to go there. I just wanted to go there. So I went down. He had been, they had taken him away by then. But I was sat in my car for an hour or two outside the hotel, just feeling a lot of things, you know, for him and gratitude and also. And the days that followed, I don't know if I'm making this up myself or whatever, but I've had this strong feeling to be connected with him, somehow connected to him, and he felt very scared and lost and so on. So I did what I could to guide him towards a higher being, to calm him down and so on. My imagination, I don't know, but it was real to me. A week or so later, I was driving my boys home, and we came. It was after midnight. It was really dark. And we lived just by a highway. And just when I was about to turn off down and park the car, there was this young guy running around in the main road trying to stop cars. And there's not a lot of traffic in the middle of the night. So I said to my boys, you go home. Mom is waiting for you. I'll see what this guy wants, you know. So it turned out that he needed to go down to town. He was desperate for some reason. I said, okay, I'll drive you. I thought I was just going to drive him down, go home again, but it turned out that it was 1.5 hour I was driving him from place to place. I don't know what he was up to. But anyway, doesn't matter. When we were on our way home, he phoned his girlfriend, and I overheard him saying, that she was working at the same hotel where Gary had died. So since I wanted to go and just know what room it was, for just to be able to go there, put my hand on the door handle or something, just to be part of the last few hours of Gary's life, I said, is your girlfriend working there? And he said, yeah. And I said, do you think maybe she could find out what hotel room it is that he used? Because I asked in the lobby and you're not allowed to give out this type of info. So he said, yeah, of course. And he said, but are you so interested in Gary? I said, yep, I am indeed. Well, he said, since you've been so kind to drive me around like this, I would like to give you a gift. I have a guitar pick from his room, and also two glasses, Jägermeister glasses, because his girlfriend were part of the people who cleaned the room after the ambulance had been there and picked up Gary after he died in his sleep. And so he said, if you want to, I would like to give them to you. And I said, once again, what are the chances? I said, I would be so honored and so happy to receive a gift like that. So a week or so later, he came. He didn't give me the guitar pick, but he gave me the glasses. And after that, several times we made a salute for Gary, wishing him well, and then I gave away these glasses to some friends that really, really appreciated him as well. So, with that in mind, I would like to suggest, see your life, appreciate the incredible gifts you have around you. You think, oh, we live in such a dark and crazy world, violence everywhere. I would like to humbly suggest, we live in a beautiful, beautiful world, but with a small little elite that are so out of order, with a mindset that are totally mad, I mean absolute mad, the craziest of the crazy, still looking very nice on TV and so on. They are so few, we're talking in the thousands, we are billions. I don't know how good you are at math, but there's absolutely no balance whatsoever. This is like a grain of sand on a beach. It is like a fart in fresh air. Time to take the power back by letting go of fear. Their tool to control us is fear. They use the media, films, TV, music, all of these things, to scare the living bejesus out of us. They do not want us to know how powerful we are, how supported we are, and so on. So if you don't know what else to do, let go of fear. Let go of fear. So that is all I can say. And whatever I can do, wherever I'm needed, frontline, with the police, with military, meeting Bilderbergers, meeting assassins, meeting gang members, going to Hell's Angels and make peace with them. I'm so happy. Whatever I can do, I'll be right there. If you want to support me, do that by donations, by my newsletter, by my books, whatever, to finance me being able to go out there and do that, because I am like a car with no gas in the tank. I need help to move physically to different areas. So let's join and let's just create the world we deserve, an absolute world of absolute beauty and harmony. And just like Bob Marley said, as his last final words, I'm just a simple man with a very simple wish. I just want to unite mankind. I feel the same. Bless you all.